It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. The April inflation numbers came out this morning, with economists expecting the rate of increase to ease to some degree. As it turns out, it eased only a tiny, tiny bit. The pace is still at more than 8% a year. Bloomberg News analyzes it this way. It says leading the way were some basic things like food, shelter, and new cars. Airfares are spiking as well. Our Michael Hill reported seeing $5 gasoline for the first time in this wave in New Jersey this week. An example of something that's not a necessity. Papa John's Pizza is reported going up by about 7% of pie. Not sure about the toppings. On something that is a necessity, there's a baby formula shortage. Maybe some of you are listening at this hour because you're a stay-at-home parent and you know this all too well. The stock market has been taking a beating so far this year. The NASDAQ, with all those tech stocks, is down a whopping 25%. The broader S&P 500 is off by 16%. But at the same time, new unemployment insurance claims have just hit their lowest level in more than 50 years. Almost everybody who wants a job can find one. And wages for regular jobs, not just the elite ones, are rising for a change. Politically, inflation has been the central economic concern Americans have been focused on in recent public opinions. In this election year, President Biden yesterday sought to direct the blame, as he identified, and empathized.
Look, I know you got to be frustrated. I know. I can taste it. Frustrated by high prices, by gridlock in Congress, by the time it takes to get anything done. Believe me, I understand the frustration. But the fact is, congressional Republicans, not all of them, but the mega Republicans are counting on you to be as frustrated by the pace of progress, which they have everything, they've done everything they can to slow down.
We'll hear more of the president's argument shortly. But what's going on, and what's the bigger picture? With us now, Greg Ipp, chief economics commentator for The Wall Street Journal. His latest article is called "The Post-Pandemic Normal is Here," and it isn't that special. Greg, thanks for coming on in the midst of all this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks very much for having me, Brian.
To start with this morning's news, the rate of inflation as measured by the Consumer Price Index stayed pretty constant last month. Economists were hoping it would be a little better than it was. What's important in these numbers as you look at them since the release in the 8 a.m. hour?
Well, the good news, such as it is that the inflation rate did actually go down. It was 8.5% in March. It came down just a tad, 8.3% in April. Unfortunately, when you dig below the surface, there's not a ton of good news there. If you look at just the change between the month of March and the month of April, it was still a pretty strong increase, which tells us that we are still some ways away from seeing the overall inflation rate trend back to that 2 to 3% level that we had before the pandemic. But there are a lot of special things going on below the surface. A big factor behind the April numbers was airfares, which rose, I think they're up something like 18% year on year.
Wow.
And if anybody has tried to book a trip lately, you know there are just enormous problems with staffing, with availability of equipment and so forth. Hopefully that's the kind of thing that does not portend more severe inflation in the months ahead.
Some of the other specifics. Why is grocery store food going up? Why is pizza chain pizza going up? We don't get our food off container ships from China, do we?
Well, if you talk to the manufacturers and the restaurant chains that supply us with the groceries and the pizza, they'll cite a number of factors. The raw materials for food have gone up. There has been a squeeze on commodities around the world, which has gotten worse with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which, as you've probably heard, is a major wheat exporter. There are shortages of labor everywhere, and that includes, for example, the slaughterhouses that prepare packaged meat, which is one of the biggest sources of food inflation. And among restaurant chains, well, a lot of these chains and restaurants laid off most of their workers at the start of the pandemic. And now that everybody wants to go out and eat again, the restaurants have trouble finding the workers that were laid off. And so they're short of staff, both cooks, waiters, and so forth. And a lot of them can't even keep their restaurants fully open. And so to get the workers they need, they're paying a lot more for them. That has to be recovered somehow. And you're seeing it show up in the prices that you pay.
And why is housing going up? We always talk about the chronic housing shortage in New York and the particular conditions of New York City housing. What's the national picture?
Well, your listeners in New York may not realize this, Brian, but New York is actually a relative bright spot insofar as the price of housing in New York is up, but it's not as up as much as it is elsewhere in the country. And there are several factors going on. One is that there's a lot of demand, and that demand comes from two sources. First of all, up until a few months ago, we had historically low mortgage rates, so that obviously made it very appealing to own rather than rent, and that created a surge in interest in buying homes. Secondly, the pandemic triggered a change in people's sort of desires about how and where to live. You've had a big exodus from big cities like New York, like San Francisco, to less populated areas, and so you see prices in places like Central Florida now going up 30% year on year. But the other thing is happening on the supply side is that builders are struggling to finish homes. They, like, you know, the supermarkets and the food chains are struggling with lack of labor, lack of parts. Apparently, it's very hard to find things like garage doors and therefore to finish the homes. So it's the same old story, Brian. Lots and lots of demand and constraints on supply.
What's happening with baby formula?
That one's a mystery, Brian. I don't think I have a really good answer for it. And it's small comfort that apparently the industry doesn't have a good answer for it. What we hear is that there are supply chain issues. Some of the ingredients that go into baby formula come from overseas, and they've been slowed down by the tie-ups and slowdowns we hear about, for example, in container shipping. Apparently, people have moved around a lot during the pandemic, and so some of the brands that people like are not in the places that they want to buy them, and so there are those distributional issues. And there was a recall associated with one of the major manufacturers, and that has temporarily reduced supply. But this is one of those mysterious things where the supply chain is so complex that it's hard to come up with a single good answer for why there's such a shortage of it. But boy, it sure is frustrating and distressing if you've got a baby who really needs a particular brand of formula.
Well, if Greg Ipp doesn't know, then I don't know. Who knows? But listeners, we're going to do a full segment just on the baby formula shortage on tomorrow's show. So heads up on that. If this is a concern for you or anybody you know, we'll do a segment on the baby formula shortage specifically and dive as deep as we can and try to get some real answers and also help you cope on tomorrow's show. Greg, you've reported, well, let me also put out a call for listeners right now who want to call in. Folks, where are you feeling inflation most in your life or business, or where are you feeling it most surprisingly? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Also, you can say who you blame and if there are any policies you would like to see pursued. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet your question or comment at Brian Lehrer with Greg Ipp, economics commentator for the Wall Street Journal. Greg, you've reported on the lockdown in Shanghai and elsewhere in China as they try to stay close to COVID zero over there, the opposite of the living with COVID approach the U.S. is taking now. There's certainly an economic toll on people living in China. Is China's approach affecting prices here?
It's certainly possible. Shanghai, the biggest city in China, is also, I think, the largest port in China, one of the largest in the world. And so the lockdown has affected the efficiency with which cargo is moving from China through that port. It hasn't come to a halt altogether, but it certainly has slowed things down. That said, when you talk to, for example, the people that operate the ports on the West Coast of the United States, they have not yet seen a big disruption in products coming into the West Coast ports. And the folks in China note that China seems to have turned the corner on COVID. A lot of the cities that had locked down because infections were rising, they have gotten infections back down to the pre-Omicron level and they're reopening. So in a little bit of time, hopefully most of those problems will go away. But I think that this points to a larger problem, something that I wrote about in the Wall Street Journal a little while ago, that it's not just China. But if you look at, for example, COVID in general, if you look at the increased trade tensions and protectionism, whether it was the trade wars that Donald Trump started or President Biden's Make It in America plans, or Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we seem to be living in a new era of supply shocks, of disruptions to the global system, integrated system of moving goods and services around. And what I worry about is that that whether it's COVID zero in China or whether it's Ukraine, we're going to have these on a regular basis in coming years. And it's just going to create an ongoing inflationary backdrop.
Turning to the longer term, your article is called "The Post-Pandemic Normal is Here and It Isn't That Special." What do you mean by "isn't that special"?
I was aiming that article at people who drove up the share prices of companies like, you know, Teladoc and Amazon, Shopify, Netflix to the moon, because they thought that in this new post-pandemic normal, nobody would ever go to a store again or a theater again, and that they would only see their doctor over Zoom. And it turned out that's not really true. Yeah, we are spending more money online and we are watching more Netflix, but it turns out that no tree goes to the sky and no trend goes on forever. And so what we have seen in the last few months is that as the Omicron wave subsides and people with vaccinations and boosters feel much more comfortable going out in public, a lot of our pre-pandemic habits are returning. We've seen a leveling off of the number of people who telework. AMC, one of the country's largest operators of theaters, has announced that they're actually doing really well with a strong quarter of ticket sales. And brick and mortar stores are amazingly telling us that people are coming back into the stores. Even gyms, it turns out that people are once again willing to sweat next to total strangers in the gym. And so that's bad news for Peloton, which was sort of, trading at billions and billions of dollars of market value on the premise that everybody would turn their spare room into a gym. So what we're seeing in the market right now is what I call a reality check. Yes, some things have changed, but not everything.
Yeah, so we see Netflix shares down 70%. PayPal down 70%, I guess, as people return to spending in person. Peloton, as you say, which makes their home exercise equipment, down more than 80% from last year's highs. Even Zoom has shed its pandemic era gains, you write. So those are, really eye-popping numbers. Do they give us a warped view of how bad the stock market is right now, because they had gone up so high when people thought this was going to be sort of more permanent?
I definitely think it's part of the story about why the stock market is struggling so much. There's basically two things going on in the market. There's a reevaluation of some of these concept stocks like Netflix, like Tesla, that had basically gone to the moon. And people are saying maybe we shouldn't have been paying like these nosebleed prices for these stocks. And they're coming back to earth. And that in and of itself is not something to worry about in aggregate sense. But we are also seeing the Federal Reserve raising interest rates to deal with our inflation problem. We're seeing ever so small hints that the economy might be slowing down. And so the broad market is responding to that. Higher interest rates, possibility of an economic slowdown.
And yet you say the world has been transformed by a certain amount of apparently permanent adoption of some of these products and services. Certainly Zoom, for example, I would think, since we see numbers from Crain's New York, for example, that only 8% of Manhattan office workers are there in person on any given day, and hybrid schedules seem to be settling in as the new normal. So how would you characterize the transformation from an economic standpoint?
I would say that we are doing certain things differently, and we will from now on. And that is really the true of every economic transformation through history, whether it was the arrival of the radio in the 20s or television in the 1950s, or the spread of the automobile, the creation of the suburbs, electrification. All these technologies and transformations did change our lives and often made them better. But there is a distinction between how much they change our lives and how much you should be willing to pay for the companies that are carrying out that transformation. And in almost every one of the episodes that I just described, there was a company or a group of companies that investors just got way too excited about, and eventually they came back to earth. And that's more or less what you're seeing right here. But that should not take away from the fact that a lot of things really are going to be different. People probably are going to be like working from home a lot more in the future than they used to. People will be using Amazon and Netflix and other streaming services more than they used to. But the things that they used to do will still be around. We'll just have a wider menu of choices ahead of us.
Here is Shino, am I saying your name right? In Bayshore. Shino, I'm sorry. Hi, Shino. Yes. In Bayshore. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, Brian. How are you? Good morning.
I'm okay. You have a report on the price of eggs, I see.
Absolutely, Brian, and that's occurred to me literally about 2 weeks ago, I went to my local Stop and Shop, and I found that the quantity, the availability of eggs was less, and the price doubled, literally and figuratively, doubled in price. And I have two elderly ladies at home that their staple breakfast comes with eggs. So, and I looked at it, the way I saw it is, if the price of eggs can go that astronomical, I mean, I don't think chickens have reduced in quantity. It's just something has gone wrong somewhere. And that is where, that gives credence to your guest analogy in terms of the supply chain is broken. And the supply chain being broken is causing the price of things to go astronomical. That's the way I see it.
Shino, thank you very much. Call us again, please. Greg, is there an egg shortage that you're aware of?
Actually, no. In fact, eggs are one of the few things that we don't hear a lot about shortages. I'm very sorry to hear about the caller's experience, but it seems to be worse than average. I just looked up the data, and the price of poultry, fish, and eggs, they don't have an index here for eggs alone, is up about 25% since the pandemic. So that is definitely 20 to 25%. That's not a doubling, but it's definitely not very pleasant. Meat is actually kind of a worse situation because, as I mentioned earlier, there seems to be a much tighter constraints on the supply of meat. In fact, the Biden administration has been arguing that that's because the meatpacking industry is more concentrated, and so they have a degree of monopoly power that enables them to keep prices higher.
Mariana in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mariana.
Hi, Brian. Such an honor to be on your show. I wanted to come on today and just briefly comment about, I work behind the counter at a little artisanal bake shop. And recently we've had to raise our prices. And though they source almost everything locally or within the USA, as we know how inflation works, it's still touched and affected. And I have to say, the most frequent question I really get is like, oh, the prices have gone up. Like, I wonder why that is. And, you know, just having to, you know, you don't think that you're going to have to talk about economics at a bake shop, but, you know, having to talk people through, oh, well, what's been going on in the Ukraine and what's been going on with inflation in general. It's just something that I've encountered in my daily life in a way I didn't expect. And yeah, definitely related.
Mariana, thank you very much. You call us again too. Gus in College Point, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gus.
Hi, how are you, Brian? Thank you very much for taking my call. And I appreciate all the information you're giving us. I'm calling because, yes, I have seen how prices are going up. Yesterday, I paid $4.69 per gallon to fill up my car, and that's cheap. I drove around, and some were up to $5. There was one that was $5.18 for the regular gas. Prices are going up for bread, for all the consumables. I sometimes, with two bags of groceries, I spend close to $100, and this is getting worse. My raise was only 1.10%. I had not received a raise in over 2 years from the company. Meanwhile, I hear my company, all the stockholders are making very large profits, and the company is very happy that we made hundreds of dollars in profits, but it's not reaching us. And that is going to get just worse. We hear how there are problems in Ukraine with gasoline, but then again, we hear also that billionaires are making a lot of money. So what's going on? That's basically it. Thank you, Brian. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Well, there's the global frustration of a lot of people, Greg, expressed by Gus in all those different areas of the economy that he just, you know, mentioned. In addition to the other callers and the specific things they brought up, but he had a whiff. He didn't quite put it this way, but he had a whiff of price gouging in that call. And that's one of the things that President Biden brought up yesterday. It's hard for consumers to know when there's just a real supply chain shortage or some other kind of pressure that's forcing places to raise prices, maybe like Mariana behind the counter as a barista. But, you know, maybe some companies are really taking advantage. How do we know?
I don't think it's easy to know. And I'm not going to dismiss those suspicions because as inflation has gone up, corporate profit margins are really quite good. And that is, in fact, the kind of evidence you would see if companies were raising prices more than they had to simply because of higher costs. Now, there's a distinction between companies being able to raise prices and make a lot of profits and then being able to do that because they have an unfair monopolistic position in the market. And this is the difficult thing to disentangle. So let's look at one particular product where prices have gone up a lot. Used cars. I think the prices were up something like 30 or 40% since the start of the pandemic. Well, we know for a fact that the used car market is very fragmented. There is no monopolistic seller of used cars. In fact, you know, millions of people sell a car every year, and they're enjoying, in some sense, these windfall profit gains themselves as individuals because there is such a shortage of used cars and such a demand for it. So we can say with some confidence that is not, in fact, what's going on here. On the other hand, we talked about meat for a minute ago. There is only a handful of meat packers, and I don't think we can dismiss the possibility that those companies are taking advantage of this squeeze right now to make extra profits. Now, Brian, I just wanted to take a minute and correct something I said a few minutes ago. I think in response to one of your earlier callers, I said that eggs had gone up less than meat, and I just was able to check some recent figures. In fact, I was incorrect. Eggs have gone up more than meat. Eggs are up about 22% in the last 12 months, and meat is up 13%.
And I think Derek on the Upper West Side has a theory as to why. Derek, thanks for calling in. You're on WNYC.
Thanks for taking my call. I'll make it quick. Duane Reade / Walgreens. I shop there regularly. They have a big store at 72nd Street and Broadway. The two-pack of, let's see if I can read this right, it's a cage-free, hard-cooked, peeled eggs. They basically boil eggs without the shell. Before the pandemic, 99 cents for the two-pack. After the first year of the pandemic, or during the first year, they went to $1.39. Yesterday, $2.49. That's my story.
Thank you very much. And I think you were going to mention something about avian flu. And sure enough, we just looked it up because you were on hold planning to say that. And we have a Washington Post article saying, yeah, at least one culprit for the price of eggs going up appears to be avian flu. So there's some more on eggs, Greg. I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah. So how was I to know that I would have to have an opinion on the price of eggs today? Like, I think that it goes back to something I was saying earlier. There's just a lot of things going on at the same time. It isn't just the pandemic and the sort of the residual shortages of labor, but there's a lot of stuff going on in the world today, whether it's avian flu. We're also seeing a lot of countries taking actions on their own, which are helpful to themselves, which end up making the rest of the world sort of suffer. For example, in Indonesia, palm oil is very important for cooking to a lot of families, but Indonesia is also one of the world's largest exporters of palm oil. In order to hold the price down at home, the government of Indonesia has banned the exports of palm oil. So in some sense, they're going to keep prices at home, but the result will be higher prices abroad. And so even unbeknownst to us, it may be that some of the higher prices we're paying today reflect those individual actions by other countries.
And by the way, Derek, if you're still listening after your call about eggs, my producer Mary says, gotta boil your own eggs, Derek. And that'll probably be good for health as well as, health and safety as well as buying them before they're cooked. All right, we're going to continue in a minute with Greg Ipp from the Wall Street Journal on the various strands of things that are going on with the economy and more of your calls. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Wall Street Journal chief economics commentator Greg Ipp as we talk about the many strands of things coming together for this unusual and fraught economic moment. And Greg, you're right that there are parallels with the dot-com bubble that burst in 2000. Can you remind us of the late 90s? Probably a lot of people who lived through them wish it was still the late 90s, when the economy looked so good in so many ways and the federal government actually ran a surplus, not a deficit, for a few years. I mean, on the surface, that feels very different to me than these pandemic years of massive unemployment from shutting down the economy and massive government spending to help people get through it, and now this inflation.
Yeah, may I also add that back then Russia was our friend, remember?
For 10
years. Yeah, no. But I think the parallel I was trying to make there was that, like, the dot-com bubble was basically about a transformation from a new technology. The internet was brand new at the time. And as we were talking about earlier, people thought this would change their lives. And they were right. They just were wrong about how much we should pay the companies to do that. And that eventually burst. And what was interesting was that the bursting of that bubble helped speed up a slowing in the economy. And then, of course, in the fall of 2001, we had the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and those kind of like pushed the economy over the edge. And I can imagine that there might be parallels to the present, where we have both the deflation of this stock market bubble making people feel less wealthy, perhaps trimming employment at the margin. And then we have a variety of other shocks, including the rising the cost of energy from Russia's invasion of Ukraine, also hitting consumers hard. I will say, though, that we don't see a lot of signs of it yet. The economy still seems to be pretty strong. Consumers are spending a lot of money. Job growth is very strong. But you kind of need to look ahead. And I think that bad as things are on the inflation front now, there are a lot of reasons to think that it will not be so bad a year from now. I mentioned that like a big factor to today's inflation was airfares. Well, they're not going to keep going up 18% per year. Used car prices aren't going to keep going up 30% per year. We've already seen that on the labor cost front, wage growth seems to have stabilized. If you look at the financial markets, if you look at the people who forecast for a living, they're telling us the inflation rate in a year from now will be 3 or 4% instead of 8%. Now, that's a lot better, and it's going to make people feel better. But it's still not acceptable in the sense that the Federal Reserve wants inflation rate to be 2%. So that doesn't mean their work is done. But the point I'm trying to make here is that if there's an old saying, if something is unsustainable, it will not be sustained. And some of these price increases, I don't think, are sustainable.
Michael in Chester in New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how you doing, Brian? Thanks for taking my call.
Good. You're not in East Chester. You're not in West Chester. You're in Chester.
That's right. I'm in Chester. Yeah, I was calling this morning because I wanted to bring up hoarding in terms of the formula shortage. And I had a comment, and then I had a question for your guest. So my comment is in response to a guest you had a couple weeks ago who was making a public health policy argument against Lena Wynne's positions. And he was basically saying that we need a societal and a cultural change in terms of public health, and we need to look at it in terms of self-sacrifice for the common good. And I wonder, I realize it's very Pollyanna to expect or even advocate something like this in our current society, but I wonder if that's not something that we should be talking about in this country from the perspective of inflation, and specifically with shortages for baby formula. So I have a seven-month-old. But it's very, very scary to find out that you may not be able to find a formula in the coming days or weeks. And what this leads to is some very real panicked hoarding. And so, you know, I just wanted to make that comment that maybe that's something that we should talk about, where instead of hoarding for ourselves, we think about, you know, what is it for other families who have to go through the same thing. But my question for the guest was, can you speak to how we measure the impact of consumer behavior in these kinds of shortages, where hoarding goes on, how that actually affects broader meta level of inflation?
Great question, Michael. Thank you very much. Greg, hoarding? I don't know if people are hoarding. Certainly at the beginning of the pandemic, there was hoarding because there were shortages. So people were hoarding paper towels and toilet paper and things like that. I took a photo on the Friday before New York City really locked down in 2020, right? So that Friday in mid-March, I think it was a Friday the 13th, in fact, and it was at Trader Joe's. And I was trying to stock up for what I thought was going to be a really long lockdown of 2 weeks, ha, 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 ha. And I went to the frozen vegetables aisle, and it was entirely empty except one very full bin of Brussels sprouts. And I thought, wow, people really don't like Brussels sprouts. Every other frozen vegetable bin at Trader Joe's that day was completely empty. And for a good reason at that time, right? People thought they were going to be locked in. They didn't know for how long, so they were stocking up on things they could freeze and use over time. But are we seeing anything like that today?
You know, there's anecdotal discussion that perhaps hoarding might be one of the reasons for the baby formula shortage. It certainly seemed to be a factor behind the toilet paper shortage 2 years ago. And much as we'd like to call on people to think broad-mindedly and above every, you know, collectively rather than just their own needs, that's not really how our market economy works. And you'll often hear people invoke the airlines, the routine you hear when you get on an airplane, which is if there's a loss of cabin pressure, put on your own mask first and then put it on and then look to others. And that's how people sort of think about these shortage periods, is that, well, I'm going to make sure that my children are taken care of first, then I'll worry about society more broadly. And that's the way we've been. I think, though, that doesn't mean there's nothing we can do. And I think there are two things, importantly, that in our sort of market-based economy with a safety net, that policymakers have to do. The first thing they have to do is reassure people that supply will be there. The best way to get people not to panic is to reassure them that the supply is on its way. So, for example, that's one of the reasons we have a strategic reserve of oil, to make sure that people know, even if there is a temporary shortage because or a disruption to the supply of oil because of, for example, a war, that it will not mean that you are going to not be able to fill up your gas tank tomorrow. And that does tend to do the job that's expected to do. So that's job number one. Job number two is to allow the market economy to work. We have a system where when there is too little supply or too much demand, prices go up. And the rise of prices is an important signal. It tells people to conserve on their consumption, drive less in case of gasoline, hoard less in the case of groceries, perhaps. And it tells producers to produce more of the thing that we need. And so there, I am fairly certain that the industry is doing its best to figure out how to make more baby formula, how to make more eggs. The semiconductor companies are working flat out to produce more semiconductors because there's a shortage, which has driven up those prices. So in the face of all the disruptions that we've had over the last year, whether it was pandemic, whether it's China COVID, whether it's Ukraine, it's hard to stay ahead of these and try and get on top of the shortages. But I'm fairly confident that with time, the market economy will do what it's supposed to do, and it will resolve these shortages.
Politics. On who to blame. Here's another clip of the president yesterday blaming Republican policies while saying he's the one doing something about inflation.
Americans have a choice right now between two paths reflecting two very different sets of values. My plan attacks inflation and grows the economy by lowering costs for working families, giving workers well-deserved raises, reducing the deficit by historic levels, and making big corporations and the very wealthiest Americans pay their fair share. The other path is the ultra-MAGA plan put forward by congressional Republicans to raise taxes on working families, lower the income of American workers, threaten sacred programs Americans count on like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and give break after break to big corporations and billionaires. Just like they did the last time they were in power, when their top priority was the reckless $2 trillion tax cut, going to the very wealthiest Americans, which ballooned the deficit, and not a penny of it was paid for.
So there's President Biden yesterday. And Greg, you're an economics commentator, not a political commentator, so I'm not going to ask you to choose up sides here in any way, but how would you compare the Democratic and Republican approaches to inflation in this midterm election year?
Well, I'm not sure there is a Republican approach. In some sense, they're taking advantage of the fact that inflation is very high and people are naturally going to blame the person in power for it. There has been some discussion that Biden's stimulus plan that was passed within a few months of him taking office added to the very strong demand that we have in the economy, and it's part of the reason we have inflation today. There's probably some truth to that, but we had a lot of stimulus under President Trump as well. So I don't think that you can say there's only one party to blame if, in fact, we've had too much fiscal stimulus. But the truth of the matter is the severe shortages and supply disruptions that we've been enduring for about 2 years, they're not the fault of anybody in power. They are traceable to these global events like the pandemic, like the invasion of Ukraine, that cannot be traced to any particular individual or policy choice. I will say, though, that there was something that President Biden said at the beginning of his remarks that was very important. He said, the main way I'm going to fight inflation is by asking the Federal Reserve to do its job. And that is absolutely key. We have an independent central bank whose job number one is dealing with inflation. And the best thing the president and Congress can do is let them do their job and encourage them to do their job. So there are several nominees to the Board of Governors of the Fed that are awaiting confirmation in the Senate. Getting those people in place will help the Fed get to full strength and do its job. President Trump regularly attacked the Fed. President Biden has not done that. And that, I think, gives it a little bit more sort of like leeway to do the necessary job. It's not going to be pleasant, unfortunately. The way the Fed gets inflation down is to cool off the economy. And the way it does that is by raising interest rates. So I think it's a pretty sure thing that interest rates are headed higher. It'll continue to be a rocky period in the financial markets. But the best thing that our political classes can do is to let the Fed do its job and indeed encourage the Fed to do its job.
Let me get two quick political reactions in here that I think are different from each other, and then we're going to be out of time. Alec in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alec.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Fine, yeah. So I was thinking about Biden. I think the message needs to be stronger and firmer. I think the key points are energy. You got oil and you got renewables. And how you handle those two things is going to direct, I believe, the economy, probably throughout the whole world in some way. And eventually, and of course, it's going to affect the market as well. I think those two factors, and I think he needs to express the direction, what's happening on those two fronts, because they're interrelated. One is going to affect the other. If we get more renewables, there'll be less demand on oil, and prices will drop of oil. So I think that's a very key issue, but the way he drives his points to the American people, maybe in details and even maybe to the big corporations as well, he needs to be, I think, very firm in how he presents it, as Trump was very firm in whatever he did.
Alec, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Greg, very briefly on that, one of the things that the Republicans are pushing is for Biden to allow more production of oil. And he's doing some things that are making progressives who are very much for renewables very unhappy. So, you know, strategic oil reserves, allowing drilling again on federal lands. These things are so fraught, but one is short term, the more production. The other is longer term, switching away from renewables. I don't know if they're apples to apples.
Well, you're right. Switching to renewables will eventually insulate us from shortages of things like natural gas and oil. But that is an extremely long process, taking decades, and it simply is not going to help us with the current price pressures we're dealing with right now. It is true that if we could somehow boost production in the United States or offshore or among our allies, that would help with the price of oil. But let's remember, this is a global market. When we produce more oil in the United States, that oil doesn't necessarily go to American consumers and lower their prices. It goes into the international market. And the effect for Americans individually is completely diluted by the fact that they have to compete with everybody else around the world for that oil. And in any case, even if the president were to, for example, make more land available for leasing and drilling, it would be at least another year or two before that oil is flowing to the market. And it's not obvious that the industry would consider that a profitable thing. So there are a lot of ideas out there how to sort of reduce our exposure to these high energy prices in the long run. But I think the harsh truth is that none of them are going to deliver relief in the next few months, which is, of course, when people really want it.
Except maybe at least a little bit, the one that Jesse in Westchester is calling about. Jesse, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And thank you, Mr. F. I loved reading you when I was reading the Wall Street Journal for 44 years. Last thing I could read before I got to the op-ed page. So thank you for, you know, all your insights there. I wanted to ask a question, your thoughts on these Republican-led states in that are relaxing taxes or taking away taxes, state taxes, that is, on gasoline and food to allay some of the price pressure that, the market is facing right now. Is it politically motivated? And more importantly, is it, you know, a fly in the face of what the Fed's trying to do and will have deleterious effects long term on inflation? Thank you.
Jesse, thank you. And it's not just Republican states. Governor Hochul got the legislature to pass a bill that's going to roll back the gasoline tax in New York State by 16 cents a gallon, at least for the summer, beginning in June, you know, feeling the political weight as she runs for reelection of people's inflation concerns. So, Greg, what we say to Jesse, and then we're out of time.
So when you lower the price of something, people consume more of it. So if you basically reduce the taxes on gasoline, you will encourage people to consume more gasoline, and that adds to the demand pressure. And so in some sense, it extends the problem. But look, I understand why these governors are doing it. It's not just red state, it's also blue state governors. People want relief right away. And so, you know, I'm not running for office. I don't hold office. I comment on the economy. So I can tell you why, from a sort of a global sense, that these tax cuts may actually, you know, drag out the problem. But as a political sense, I also understand why they're doing it. But at the end of the day, I think the tax cuts are probably too short-lived and too small to really make a big difference in the aggregate sense.
Greg Ipp is chief economics commentator for the Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much. I could tell our listeners really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Brian.